My conversation with farmer and political activist Lindley Thorne revolved mainly around the idea of community, present-day agriculture, and politics in rural communities. Lindley has a great deal to say about improving the lives of people in rural communities and much advice to members of both major political parties, of whom neither get out of this discussion without some heavy criticism. So Democrats and Republicans, put your thick skin on and listen. I interviewed her on her farm in Western Virginia. I'm here with Lindley Thorne, and I'm going to ask her to tell us a little bit about herself. Lindley, were you raised in a rural community?
Yeah, I was. I was raised in Summerfield, North Carolina. I grew up in a log cabin that my parents built with their friends. I grew up next to a dairy farm. We always had a huge garden, so grew up pretty connected to the earth and to my source of food. When I was in high school, though, we did move into town, Greensboro, which to me felt like a huge city, and I hated it. I spent most of my time in Greensboro on my bike, getting to the park, getting to the river, to the creek, somewhere that felt like home. I have a small farm with my young children, and actually we have a young couple that moved here about a year ago, built a tiny house, and they operate a beautiful CSA. I have and continue to some degree to raise grass-fed beef, lamb, chicken, free-range eggs. I spend more of my time in off-farm pursuits, which really is pretty common as we see an aging farming population. As a single parent, it's really hard to have my primary income be at the farm.
So why are you here?
Just have a love of getting my hands dirty and being very connected to my food and the people who provide for our community.
Tell us a little bit about the region.
There's a strong Mennonite community here. Harrisonburg and Rockingham in particular are a refugee welcoming community. So that means that we have a lot of diversity. We have a Sudanese community. We have a very strong Kurdish community. A lot of other immigrants in the area coming from a lot of different parts of the world, many of them being here for multiple generations. I think something I love about smaller communities is a heightened level of accountability. You really are truly connected to the people in your community, and your actions are noted. Your impact is something to be aware of, and I think that's a really nice thing for us to have in community, to truly have community.
So this Rockingham County where you live now, would you classify that as rural?
Absolutely. Harrisonburg is certainly has a more kind of suburban vibe, although I like to point out to anybody feeling too high and mighty in the big city of Harrisonburg that the tallest building on the skyline, y'all, is the chicken processing plant. On a rainy day, this whole section of the valley sometimes smells like wet dog food. Rockingham County is the turkey capital of the world, and a rich, very long history of agriculture.
What are some of the things that you like about a rural environment? And it sounds like maybe in your early years, you were in a very rural environment versus a semi-rural environment versus a rural suburban environment. You know, and just talking to you, it seems like we have all these different layers.
Yeah, I think so. There's always a different vibe in any community. But I think some common themes that really appeal to me about rural life is the connectivity of our community. I lived in a very urban setting. I lived in Ho Chi Minh City, also known as Saigon, for a number of years, and that is a huge, bustling city. I lasted there for a few years before moving back to the countryside, also in Vietnam, to sell fish in the market. And even in rural Vietnam, that heightened sense of accountability and connectedness and awareness of who is in your community and what value they bring to your community and the need to care for each other. All of those things are really appealing to me rather than kind of the anonymity that can exist when you're in a city.
The statistics show that the rural communities are being hollowed out. How can we stop this? Is it worth stopping? Do you see a shift in rural environments? And if so, what does that look like?
I absolutely share your concerns, and I think the challenges are daunting.
Not all rural communities are agricultural, but it's difficult to have a big agricultural community community and not be in a rural environment.
I believe Rockingham County is the largest agricultural locality in Virginia. When you're driving around in the more rural parts of Rockingham, you will see Dollar General after Dollar General and 7-Eleven after 7-Eleven. The people who live in this community do not have access to locally grown fresh food. That is insane. You can't make that make sense. We have decided to create this system that is entirely absurd. That shouldn't be a thing. We're completely surrounded by farmland. We absolutely have the ability to feed ourselves. And yet people are eating and having to eat food from a Dollar General rather than food from their own yard or from their neighbors. One of my favorite quotes comes from regenerative farmer Bill Mollison. He says something along the lines of, "The challenges we face are increasingly complex, but the solutions are embarrassingly simple."
What are the simple solutions?
I feel really overwhelmed about where we need to go from here, and it's easy to feel that. I try to center myself on what the most accessible solutions could be. I do believe that they're there, but we need to be far more intentional than we have been about seeking those out. What makes rural communities unique and distinct is that you don't get to be a bad actor and have the privilege of anonymity. We know who you are. We know who your family is. We know where you live. There's something really beautiful about that. I think it's something that, just to be honest, the way that a lot of my neighbors have responded to the pandemic, the wearing or lack of wearing of a mask, is a real indicator, at least in my mind, of your care for and accountability to those around you. It is saying, I understand that my well-being is very directly wrapped up in yours. We're in this together. I felt a lot of grief around that in my own community because we get it here, my cattle have run out on the road before, and some of my neighbors who I barely knew at all at the time helped me line up a row of random cars to create a cattle chute that we could then push them back into the farm using just a row of, a bunch of random cars. And it was a moment where we had a crisis that was going to impact us all, in the form of my cattle not being where they were supposed to be, and all of us needing to find a way to use the resources at hand to get them back in. It's harder to maintain that fear with that direct connection, with that piece about truly not just knowing, but feeling that your own personal well-being is directly wrapped up in the well-being of those around you. And so you want them to do well, and you want to reach out when they're not doing well. And they want to do the same for you. I think we experience grief when we feel disconnected from each other. A lot of hope exists in rural communities where you do exactly that. You don't walk away when somebody's pulled over on the side of the road. You can't, because somebody's going to see that you drove past and be like, what the hell? Why
is that accountability piece too?
Right, exactly. I think there's a lot to build on from rural communities. There's a lot to look at and point to and say, there's so much value in the way that we're connected to each other. Where can we take this? And I think the disruptor here is corporate interest in the industries that we depend upon for our livelihood. And as long as we were in control of farming within our communities, as long as family farm were really empowered to fully realize the value of their labor to grow their food, we were in a really much healthier place on every level, but we lost our power. It got taken from us. And I don't know how we come back from that, but I know that individual people at the local level need to feel that they are empowered in determining their current situation and the future. And I don't think you get young people to stay or move here until that shift is made. Anytime you say rural for a half a second, people are going to say broadband. It's become like a reflex, It's like people in cities might not know anything about rural communities. If they hear that word, they're going to just say broadband. So I don't want to talk too much about it, except to say that I do think it's transformational for our communities if we provide that access, which is not a luxury, as I think it has been kind of framed. It's an essential need. But it would also empower farming communities to stay connected as we look to kind of escalate or accelerate some of the solutions that might exist or bringing younger people into farming. Farming is deeply humbling, scratching up a piece of earth and planting a seed. I mean, there's a certain element there that feels like you're in control. You're deciding where to plant something. You're trying to control for its moisture. But a storm comes along, a pest comes along, they kill an animal, they take your crop, and all of the work and investment that you put into control and bring life to feed people, sometimes that is met with catastrophic devastation. And that is truly humbling. And to be so directly and intimately connected with how tenuous our existence can be, incredibly humbling. I don't see a long-term sustainable pathway to continue to invest in vertically integrated industrial farming practices. These exploit our environment, our animals, the human beings that work in these conditions from the first seed planted, chick hatched out of an egg, until it is packaged in a factory that is typically includes incredibly dangerous working conditions. So from start to finish, that is a system that has gutted American rural communities. And we will continue to be on that path unless we find meaningful ways to disrupt it. I do think there are models that exist that might potentially be a path forward, but it's not something we talk about enough. I think what you invest in financially is an expression of what you value, right? So if we used to place that much more value on our food than we do now and not be truly directly connected to how our food goes from the earth to our plate, we are in a lot of trouble. And I think having conversations like this is really, really important, because people eat multiple times a day and somehow mystifyingly don't think much about how that food got to them. And for good reason, because people are having to work two or three jobs. Like, when are they going to have time to think about this? And I want to be clear that people in the cities, the working class and the working poor in the cities, face a lot of the exact same challenges that we face in rural communities. And I think when we have these conversations, it's really important to not make the mistake of pitting rural communities against urban or suburban communities. I think we share a lot of the same overall concerns. We all want access to good education, affordable health care, clean drinking water. Everybody cares about this, and we're all impacted by it. I think a big challenge for rural communities in getting our message out is that we've lost our local newspapers. We've lost a voice along with industrialized farming, where everything is sort of homogenized. So is our method of communicating to people. It's all kind of coming from very few sources. When we look at the issues that we see with food and food safety in particular, when we are scaling up our food to have so many animals, so much plant material in one location, we really set ourselves up for public health crises. And we're going to continue to see that until we recognize that diversity is better. And by that, I mean ensuring that we are growing a variety of things. Whenever we try to create systems that are monoculture and not understanding of a complex ecosystem, we really cause a lot of harm immediately, but long term.
When I was having the conversation with Clay Jenkinson, he called it an industrial militaristic agricultural complex.
Was it Earl Butz who said the get big or get out? And that has had a catastrophic rippling effect on how we farm, how we get food to people's plates. And to be so dismissive of what was something to be so proud of, that you had a family garden, that you yourself were growing food. I think a hopeful sign, any opportunity people have to come together to share food, like we're doing this over the holidays or any special occasion, people love to tell you about their grandma's recipe for pickles or whatever. We have these real emotional connections to the image of grandma and her apron and her very special recipe that she used to put up and preserve cucumbers. And we're losing those stories. It's unfortunate to eat a meal and not have that true connection to the ground on which it was raised and a full appreciation of how it came to your plate. I think there's some people like Chris Newman. He has a really interesting model. He is a Black Indigenous farmer. He is trying to make food truly accessible to working class people, because a lot of the time we've had this farm to table movement, which is great and can make us feel good, but the food is more expensive. When you go to the grocery store and you're buying Pilgrim's chicken, what you don't maybe realize is that you've already paid for that chicken a couple times over with your taxes, because that is subsidized chicken. Well, when I put chicken out there, or somebody like Chris Newman puts chicken out there, it's going to cost more per pound because you're seeing the real actual cost of getting that food to your plate. There are people out there that are actively trying to address this, but one of the biggest barriers for new farmers, the biggest barrier, is just access to land in the first place. I don't know what I'm doing here. I know that I got to a place in my own life where I had to pull back some of my own labor from this farm. So I reached out to a friend who runs Dexter Cattle. His cattle now come here and they're rotating through my pastures. I'm not able to provide that labor, but these cattle need pasture to graze on. So the land is being used and cultivated. This young couple that has moved here and is operating a CSA, they've wanted to farm for a number of years and didn't have access to land. So they're here. They're growing their food. I love having them here. It just by accident, they have become a very natural part of my family. My children adore them. So my hope is that we can find a path for them to be here very, very long term. And I think there are some solutions, maybe like this one, where we are making intentional efforts to get people in their teens, 20s, early 30s, get them access to land, and make sure that we're being really intentional about creating that access.
The economics of agriculture certainly don't work. They don't work for the people that are trying to make a living in agriculture and the people that are producing the healthy food. It's set up to support the industrial, militaristic agricultural complex. And so if you've got young people that would love to work with their hands and learn how to farm, they've got so much going against them. They've got the 10 years of learning how to farm that it takes to learn how to farm. They don't have access necessarily to land, the machinery, $250,000 for a tractor, transportation, and all of that. Even attracting labor to the farm is so difficult. So if you can pay people $30 an hour who are kinesthetic learners and want to work with their hands and provide them health care, then you might be able to attract young people to the farm. There's got to be a legislative solution, because when you look at, you know, other countries, France, Italy, they really support their agriculture. America supports their agriculture the least of any first world country in the world. Less than 2% of our population is now producing food for the other 98.5%. So that's a lot to ask out of 1.5% of the population. That's a big, heavy load to carry without any help. You know, Clay's suggestion was that everybody in Congress should have to raise one meal a year of their own food. So I don't know.
I love that suggestion. I would love to see that happen. There was a moment in my life that I will remember forever. Towards the end of the first year of farming, I cooked a meal. It was a long day. It was towards the end of summer. Doing a bunch of farm chores. I'm roasting a chicken over a fire because at the time we were living in a cabin that had very sketchy electricity and no plumbing at all. We had some creative ways to cook our food. I did not realize until I started putting food on individual plates. My parents were visiting. I caught my breath because I realized every single thing on that plate had been grown right here by us. The exceptions were, you know, oil, salt, pepper, a few things like that. That was hard to get that one meal. Tremendous amount of effort and losses and screw-ups. I think that would be a wonderful thing if folks in government had that kind of experience. And to your larger point, we need a systemic way to address this. Maybe the toehold is to look at some of the absurdities that exist. We have to have a systemic shift. And I agree, there have to be people with a strong, long background in farming to be at the table delivering solutions here. And I think of that small percentage that you're talking about, 1.5, 2% of the population feeding the other 98, even within that small 2%, much, much fewer of those folks are outside of the industrial, what did you call it? The military industrial complex of farming. We're up against a lot of challenges. So it obviously requires a systemic approach. And I think one thing that people who are concerned about this can advocate for to be much more vocal about it. And I think on our end from farming communities, we probably need to be better at articulating what the solutions are so that when we are asking people to speak to this, that we are asking them to do so in a way that is solutions oriented.
So Lindley, if you could wave your magic wand, what would a healthy rural agricultural community look like?
I think there has to be a clear pathway to end subsidized farming practices in this country. No longer funding these really poor systems that we have that are harming ourselves, our environment, our workers, our animals. It's so complex, right? Because workers who need access to this food are currently not being paid anywhere near a living wage. It's completely insane that people are working two or three jobs, still maybe have a very fragile level of access to healthcare. Workers need to be paid appropriately for their work so that they can access this food. There's a lot of creative ideas out there about aquaculture. So like a farm like this, I have fantasized many times about tiered kind of terraced places here on the hilltops where there would be ponds, where the fish emulsion is then pumped out to crops, and where we're growing annual crops in with our perennial crops to facilitate the improvement and cultivation of additional topsoil and then not losing as much to evaporation and runoff, because we are being really intentional about a diversity in our grasses and perennial crops that are typically going to have much deeper, longer root systems. Something that I've noticed just in the 7 years that I've been here at this farm is that there used to be a lot more rocky outcroppings where you could really see exposed rock on the hillsides. Rotationally grazing cattle, they build topsoil. I think we have a lot of damaging language around the meat industry, and we need to be really careful and specific in our language about how concentrated farming operations absolutely contribute to climate change and to global warming. But rotationally grazing cattle, we have so many animals that depend on the existence of grasslands for their survival. Grasslands and also the verges where pasture meets forest. There's no way for us to have grasslands without ruminants, cattle, sheep, goats, animals who are going to trim grasses. They trample the earth. They actively push seed into the soil with their activity. Obviously, they're fertilized with their manure. They are participants in agriculture. When we need to grow produce, we need animal material to feed all of our greens, fruits. Like all of these things are interconnected. So when we completely remove all livestock from the scene and we say we're only going to eat plant-based, and I think people should eat a lot of plants. I think that's great. I have no objection to that. And of course, nobody should eat anything that they feel uncomfortable eating. I certainly would not advocate that somebody who is just doesn't want to eat meat, that they need to eat meat. They don't. I do think we need to be truthful and aware about what it means to the earth and to each other to grow livestock and produce.
There's a lot of mistrust and misinformation out there. How do we build trust?
You brought me some sausage and beef from your farm today that I am very excited about trying out. I trust you. I trust you and I trust Michael and your farming practices and the work that you put in to get this food to be in a place where someone like me can eat it. But that is a relationship. I know you. There's a contract that exists. And I think that might be where some of the fear comes from. Because if you don't know who grew your food, you don't have a contract with them. You don't have a relationship. Who are you going to go to except to file a class action lawsuit if you eat some spinach and get sick? If I get sick eating this pork, you can get a call from me. That's not going to happen, though, because we aren't using the types of farming practices that generate health issues. So I think the absence of that social contract, what makes rural communities unique and distinct, is that you don't get to be a bad actor.
You know, it always circles back around to the economics. How can we afford to pay people to produce food in a way that is healthy and sustainable for all of us on many different levels? I don't know. Legislative? Well, yeah, that would be one help. Maybe some kind of private partnerships with hobby farms, maybe something written into conservation easements. I don't know.
All of those definitely are on the table. I think there are some cooperative models that exist, but I think they all require some level of external funding just to be viable. I think our attitudes about the people who feed us are not helpful in any way at all, because to be truly skilled at this work requires a deep understanding of patterns of biology, of so many different things, the stereotypes that we use as ammunition against farmers and just rural communities in general. I see this in my political work very frequently, where people are very comfortable expressing a high level of disdain for rural communities and the assumption that the people in our communities are not very bright. I would invite anybody with that type of attitude to come on out here, put in a full season, and put that food on their plate, just like you suggested our legislators should do. I think that might change their attitude towards our communities pretty quickly. But we are going to need brilliant young minds to look at incredibly complex issues and work within an incredibly complex environment and deliver and be able to cultivate and coax food from a ground that we have abused. And we will not get them here, and we will not deserve to have them here if we cannot make this work financially viable. I am not farming full time because I can't afford to. I mean, it's a completely insane thing that we all must eat, but every single farmer I know without exception has an off-farm job. It's literally not even possible to grow food so everybody else can keep living and do that without having a second job. And one of the biggest reasons, not the only, but one of the biggest reasons is that how are you going to get health care? It's a very common sight here in the western side of Virginia, all over Appalachia. They'll come to the county fair, they'll set up their tents, and for 2 or 3 days, you've got doctors and nursing staff providing the only access to health care that a tremendous number of rural citizens will, they'll wait in line for hours to be seen by someone in here in this country. And the most common thing that they come for is to have rotting teeth pulled. We've made a choice, and it's a policy choice. We can choose not to. We simply don't make that choice. So I don't know what it's going to take to jolt enough people awake. You know, you said our average age of the farmer is like 58. I believe here in Virginia, it's quite a bit higher. I think 58 is like the national average. I believe the average age in Virginia was closer to 64. To me, that's terrifying. As long as the grocery store shelves are full, nobody's going to ask a question about it. Because who has time? People are overwhelmed with so many other burdensome pieces of everyday life. Who has time to ask a question when there's a bag of chips, there's a fast food restaurant, grab that food and go and get through the rest of the challenges of life without asking questions? And I'm concerned that we won't ask the question before it's too late.
I had a glimmer of hope during COVID. All of a sudden, then people were calling us at the farm saying, hey, do you have some meat we can have? You know,
it wanted to like move to your farm or started to like,
it was crazy. All this stuff keeps me awake at night. And we haven't even started talking about politics. It takes years and years and years to learn how to farm because of the stereotypes. People think it's pretty easy. And that collective wisdom of soil knowledge and all of that, we're going to lose a lot of that.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought this up.
You know, one of the things I do when I'm talking in front of a crowd, I'll say, okay, let me see a show of hands. How many of you out there would go to work for free? Come on, raise your hands. Oh, no takers? Okay, well, how many of you would pay to go to work? None of you? Well, that's what you're asking farmers to do.
Exactly. I think the heritage piece is hard to talk about without just directly talking about white supremacy and its role in the loss of knowledge, and specifically knowledge around farming that was truly holistic and truly deeply in touch with nature, centered around a respect for nature. So when we stole land from indigenous people, when we forced through enslavement people to work in a very extractive system, a lot of that knowledge is exactly what would save us right now, realistically. And we have removed the people and their many generations of deep knowledge and respect for this earth and what it can produce for us and with us and what we give back to it. We are supposed to also be giving back to the earth, not simply taking. The relationship that we have with the earth has become very, very one-sided. I think white supremacy honestly has a huge role in that mentality that we are entitled to just take labor, to take culture, to take knowledge, and to take it in a way that shows no respect. A lot of farmers that I know, and I did this myself, I watched a ton of YouTube videos on farming, how to butcher a chicken. Like, I did actually go to farms and do chicken butchering, but I didn't want to just show up having never done it before. Well, I had never done it before because nobody in my family was doing that. You lose generational knowledge when one generation walks away from the farm. That's all it takes. It's completely gone. It's really an uphill climb to get that back. And you mentioned 10 years that you need to put in to learn how to farm. I mean, I don't think you ever learn how to farm. I wonder if that number isn't even quite a bit higher, and it just looks a lot different because instead of having right there next to you, your mother, your father, your aunts, uncles, cousins, grandparents, great aunts and uncles in that space, you are having to learn from strangers on the internet. That's where we are. And I've certainly learned a lot of truly helpful things that way, but that's just a very weird and absurd choice that we have made and I think are gonna suffer from.
So glad we're having this conversation, Lindley. You've just really given me some wonderful things to think about. Now we move over to the political arena. Over the last couple of decades or more, the rural communities have slowly trended from being heavily Democrat to heavily Republican. So I just wanted to get your thoughts on why that's happened, how that's happened.
Yeah, it's kind of complex, but really kind of simple. I think the Democratic Party saw where the movement was towards the cities, towards the suburbs, in doing the cold calculating math of electoral politics, realizing that they could win just hunkering down there. We walked away from these conversations. It's not that Republicans are in our communities offering solutions, but they are here. They are present. And in the absence of a strong presence of by Democrats, it's really easy to get sucked into the Republican message of not here's the solutions, but here's who to blame for your problems. What we saw in Donald Trump is really just a many years long build into, of course you're angry. No one sees you. No one cares about you. I do. The valuable thing that he brought to the table and that Republicans bring to the table in rural communities is a validation of the anger that we very understandably feel. In my own political circles, which are firmly on the left, the people that I align with most politically have a very strong tendency to speak about rural communities with a lot of disdain and disrespect. People are very comfortable in saying it's a lost cause. They're too far gone. These communities used to vote for Democrats. And we don't play a very long game, do we, if we know that we used to be the party of poor working people and we used to be right next to them. And now it sounds like we're over them. And that is not something that is well received. Don't come out here and tell us what you think we should be doing, or what you think the solutions are, or act dismayed and mystified when people out here didn't vote your way, when you didn't bother to show up and sit with them and sit next to them and not talk at them, but listen to them and work on solutions in partnership and collaboration and see our communities for the brain trust that they are. Talked about the loss of that generational knowledge and that heritage. That's what's happening here on the political scene too. We have walked away from understanding and embracing the value that rural people bring to the political solutions that we need. And so you said, you know, we need more people with farming backgrounds who are serving in elected office. I couldn't agree more. And the fact that we don't have more of them is, again, a turning away from the value that rural people can bring to the table. I think maybe some glimmers of hope, but honestly, another truly damning indictment of the Democratic Party in rural communities is the loss of support from members of labor unions. Unions across the board, of course, have really been depleted over the last several decades, although I'm hopeful in the movement that we're seeing now. And maybe it's one of the silver linings of COVID where people are saying, I deserve better. I don't need to be treated this way and exploited by an employer that doesn't care for me. But the unionized workers were our people. They were our voters. The 9th Congressional District was in the hands of Democrats for a pretty long time. We won there because we were there, and we just stopped being there. And we started speaking down to people and not being next to them. So the losses we've suffered in rural communities as Democrats are our own doing, our own negligence. It's not that hard to then turn that around and be there and invest in the people who are there doing this work. And there's lots of them. I think there's a lot of hand-wringing right now within the Democratic Party. Oh, what do? We know this is a problem. We feel overwhelmed by this problem. It feels very comfortable for us to just say, it's too hard, let's walk away. I'm not impressed by a party that claims to hold values like justice for all, inclusion for all. You fight for those values everywhere. You don't leave a community behind when those are the values you care about. You don't go and show up where it's easy to win, where it's easy to make your case. You show up even more in the spaces where it's harder to do so. If you are so grounded and centered that your values will improve people's lives, then you make sure to get out there and get your message everywhere. You don't turn away. We have lost our credibility. We can get it back. It takes work. I've seen a lot of stuff out there about, you know, let's send this digital ad and let's do, there's not a cheap trick. Nobody's going to be won over by that. There's not a gimmick. It is going to require shoe leather, hard work, and a long-term year-round investment and commitment.
Aren't there in Virginia at least 400,000 rural votes?
There's 500,000 votes. That's just that's Western rural Virginia. That is not rural Virginia as a whole. We have been begging for attention and engagement for a very, very, very long time. Rural communities are tight-knit. If you're talking to 10 people, you're not really talking to 10 people. You're talking to all the people that those 10 people are going to talk to when they leave your farm.
But we do need help and resources because we are stretched thin, because we are working two or three jobs. Stereotype of the independent yeoman farmer is somewhat not true because we are so connected and we do depend on each other.
We've certainly seen the Second Amendment sanctuary movement that was happening in 2020, and now all of the stuff that we've seen on school boards around not real issues like critical race theory being taught in K-12 schools, which of course it's not and never has been. The draw of shooting your guns into a target and ripping around in your four-wheeler, people are tired of being told what to do in their 9-to-5, when to take a bathroom break, when to go to lunch, not being able to have access to very basic things. So people are looking for outlets. I'm not here to defend 2Aers and these folks. That's not what I'm about. But I am trying to find out the why, because I think it's important to actually put in an investment of time and effort to figure out the why rather than wishing it away. Being a white person in a rural community who's very uncomfortable with the rise of just very loud white supremacy, like we shouldn't be comfortable with it when it's quiet, but it's getting very loud. I want to find the why of it. I think there is a pathway to deliver real solutions to people. And going back to that quote where I said the problems of the world are increasingly complex, but the solutions are embarrassingly simple. Do good for people. It's not hard. Are we doing good for people? And are we doing that in a way that is in direct community and collaboration with them? Because if we're not, that's what we need to fix. You know, I'm hearing a lot of people say, well, rural voters vote against their interests. Do you know their interest? Like, have you talked to them and sat down with them? Because even if you are ultimately doing good for them, if you're not doing that good with them, you've lost. You're going to lose. Don't tell us what's good for us. Be in partnership, be in collaboration, be next to us in this space. The solutions are there. It's a lack of will.
That's about it for me. Was there anything else that you wanted to say that you didn't get to say?
I would feel uncomfortable walking away from this conversation not doing more to impart some type of hope, and to do that in a way that I think is grounded in realistic, achievable goals. I think they're there. I think the solutions are there. I think our biggest challenge at the moment is convincing more people to engage, to not be so afraid that they don't take that first step, that they don't commit to the work. You might not know what the answer is. You might not know that you're going to get the result you're looking for immediately. There's not going to be instant gratification here. Engaging, truly engaging and collaborating and giving people the mic and trying to offer them power to address the problems that they face on a daily basis, you will win people over if you show up for them. And I think if we do that, we'll be okay.
I have great hope too. Okay, well, Lindley, gosh, thanks so much for this. This was just an amazing, terrific conversation. And I feel very honored to be able to talk to some of the best minds that are thinking about these issues. And we certainly count you among that population. So thanks so much. You have been listening to Rural. I am your producer, Amy Drury, in collaboration and partnership with the Virginia Humanities and Healthy Suffolk. Thank you for listening. And thanks to WHRO for their help and support.